Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is Thursday, May 4th, and tonight we're talking with the editor and several contributors from the book, What I Didn't Know, True Stories of Becoming a Teacher. I'm your host, Rachel Baer, and I'm coming to you from my home office with the National Writing Project in Boise, Idaho. And tonight, I'm very excited about the show that we're bringing to you as we celebrate Teacher Appreciation Week. We'll be talking about why teachers join and stay in the teaching profession despite all the challenges of being a teacher. And this book, What I Didn't Know, is a collection of teacher stories that are all about those things. So one thing to know, as always, any links we mention during the show will be included in the archive of the show. And tonight we are pleased to have several guests from the book to talk with us. So we are welcoming Lee Goodkin, who is the founder and editor of Creative Nonfiction Magazine, and he has taught the art of narrative nonfiction for more than 30 years. We're also welcoming Mike Kopperman, who teaches low-income, first-generation college students of diverse background at the University of Oregon and is the author of the memoir Teacher through the University Press of Mississippi. And then we have also with us Marcia DeSantis, who is a journalist, essayist, and author of a New York Times bestseller, 100 Places in France, Every Woman Should Go, and her work has appeared in numerous publications. We are also welcoming Chris Gurman, who is an immigration attorney and an assistant professor of creative nonfiction writing at Point Park University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And finally, we have Anne Kloss with us, who is a teacher, mother, and writer, and she is a head of school at Laurel School in Shaker Heights, Ohio. So thank you all for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Rachel.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Rachel.
So I think to get us started, I'm hoping that Lee, you'll get us started and that you'll provide us with some background on the book, including the process you went through for putting it together.
Sure. Thank you, Rachel. I should say right away that these aren't just teacher stories. These are true teacher stories. So nobody has made these stories up. These are stories that capture a teacher's life, more than 20 teachers' lives. From all kinds of different spectrums, written in the creative nonfiction way. And the way in which we have gone about getting these stories is simply to ask for them. We ask, we advertise, saying that we are going to publish these stories, we're seeking them, and we put them in the magazine, we send emails to people who are teachers, to people we know who are writers, and we received about 400 essays, true stories from all across the world, mostly from the United States, and we winnowed them down to about 20. And I'm telling you that that was a very difficult job to do. We screened them. We have over 20 screeners looking at each story and making recommendations. And so those that you see and read in What I Didn't Know are the best of the best. And there weren't any bad essays at all. They were all quite terrific. These just worked the best for us. So that's what we do. It takes a long time, and we do it for all kinds of different reasons. One, creative nonfiction is a really important genre these days. It's the fastest growing genre in the publishing industry and in the academy, and it is beginning to become incredibly popular in middle schools and high schools. So, and you know, it's a funny thing about teachers, and if you kind of look at the news these days and read the papers or watch TV, lots of folks talk about education, but very few folks talk about the engines that make education work, and that is the teachers. And so it was our idea to try to capture what it's like to be in the trenches of high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, and ask teachers to tell stories that reflect the challenges and satisfactions of their lives. And to do it, creative nonfiction is always a story. The idea behind creative nonfiction is to communicate really important ideas and information, but to do it in such a way that it is written almost, not quite, like a short story or a novel, so that it will compel readers, general interest readers who may or may not have an interest in education and in teachers, to read those stories. And these were really impactful, sometimes heart-wrenching, sometimes amusing, always compelling stories that we received. And I should say something else about those who wrote these stories, those teachers who wrote these stories. It's interesting to me that so many teachers learn as they become educated and prepared to become teachers. So many teachers learn how to teach writing, but don't often, unless they choose to do so and try to do so, don't often take writing courses on their own. They kind of are self-taught writers in many respects. So it's really amazing and wonderful how these teachers have captured their world in such a way that that it has impacted a large readership and captured magic moments that only teachers can realize and know.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that reminder that these are true teacher stories, and that there is so much power in the truth in these teacher stories, and also what you said about the range of places that people are coming from and where they teach, because I think the collection as a whole also really shows that wide range of experiences teachers might have. I'll just say I was a classroom teacher for 10 years before I started working for the National Writing Project. And every one of these stories really resonated with me as I thought back to my early years in teaching and those challenges and satisfactions, as you said, that you get, and then the reasons why you stay in the profession or stay in education. So really, those reminders about this collection and where people are coming from and the range of stories, it's really helpful. And also, I appreciate your point about teachers being writers themselves, and it's actually one thing that we talk about a lot in the National Writing Project, is how much it enhances your teaching of writing when you engage in the craft yourself. I just feel like it's so important for us to keep hearing these stories from teachers and their experiences.
Well, thanks. I too believe that, and it was a great opportunity to read these true stories and to just I've been teaching for a long time, but I never did teach K through 12, and so I learned a great deal about what it was like to go to work every single day and be challenged every single day for 42 or 45 minutes, six or eight times every day. It's quite an amazing challenge, and the satisfaction in the end is clear in all of these true stories. What we do, what teachers do for their students, and how we help our students move ahead, both by teaching information, scholarship, but also engaging with them and dealing with their character, is really quite inspiring.
It really is. Very true. Thank you. So I think we'll go ahead and transition to hearing more about some of these stories and getting to hear some of the words from the writers themselves. So what we'll be able to do is spend a few precious minutes with each of the four of the teacher writers that we have here this evening. And I thought I would start with Anne. So Anne, how about let's start by hearing how and when you decided to become a teacher.
Thanks, Rachel. Sometimes I think I was doomed to teach. I loved to teach animals, stuffed animals, and I loved books about teachers. I wanted to be Jo in Little Women because she grew up to be a school teacher. I went off to college and began volunteering teaching drama in a housing project. That led me to sign up to be in a teacher preparation program where I could get certified to teach English, but not drama. I did a lot of teaching in the public schools and had that kind of starry-eyed dream that that's what my path was. But I couldn't be certified to teach drama at my college, and so I ended up in a prep school in New England, a boarding school, teaching English and theater in 1982. And I pretty much haven't stopped since. And I now have the huge joy and privilege of leading a girls' school in Ohio. But I am also a teacher. Right around my office right now are the costumes for the primary play, because the girls and I write it together and develop it through improv. And typically I teach ninth grade English, though I hear I might be promoted to teach 10th grade next year, and I wouldn't have to teach Oedipus Rex for the 35th time. So that would be pretty exciting.
Wow, that's great. So I'm sure there are a lot of moments that stand out to you in all those years of teaching. Could you maybe tell us about a moment that really stands out to you in your memory?
Well, I'll tell you a funny moment that's in the chapter. I'm not sure I've ever exceeded it. I was reading Lady Macbeth to some 10th graders, and I reached up my arm and said, "Come thick night," and all the lights went out in the whole building. And my 10th graders were agog. And there are moments where you're a teacher and you just laugh. You know, the kids really, I think, thought I had summoned some supernatural powers to turn off the electricity. It doesn't get much better than that, particularly when one is a drama in English. But so many moments along the way. That's just a funny one that I thought I would share with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about, like, the first years of teaching? Was there anything that was really challenging for you, or what was your experience like in those first years of teaching?
I think that teaching in a boarding school is a baptism by fire. It's like drinking from a fire hose because you're with kids 24/7. I loved it. I had not gone to boarding school, but I was a dorm mother for boys, which was a little bit of a shockeroo. I'd gone my whole life to a girls' school, and I'd gone to a co-ed college, but I'd certainly never lived on a corridor with a lot of teenage boys. I think sometimes I was never older than I was those first couple of years because I was so afraid of being unmasked and having the kids realize how young I was and how much I worried that I didn't know enough. But in my becoming a teacher, I think so much of teaching is learning that your own authentic self is enough. And I guess my confidence has also grown sort of with my humility, that kids aren't actually asking you to have all the answers. Kids are looking to adults to listen and to take them seriously and to care for them and to have a really high bar. And that, for me, has been an incredible privilege.
Wow. And will you tell us a little bit more about what it was like to teach in that context when you were so young in a school
Sure.
like that?
So my husband and I started a residential summer theater program when we were really too young to know better. That's the topic of my story in the anthology. And sometimes I think when you are young and intrepid and you sort of don't know any better, you are courageous and brave. And I think for me, it was, you know, going out and having the chutzpah to raise money and recruit kids and hire a faculty and say, yes, we can. We can make theater in a way that we didn't see. My husband was in professional theater, and I had worked in a couple of summer programs, which I thought were sort of lackluster. And we had the sort of guts to say, we're going to do it our own way and have kids live with us and our faculty in a big old dilapidated summer house. I will never forget the euphoria of we made this. We ran for 27 summers. We're sort of on hiatus right now. But I think for me, the gusto and the exhilaration of the full immersion of thinking about theater 24/7 with a group of impassioned high school kids, some of whom had never made a play before, but all of whom ended up with us in this little town called Eaglesmere because they wanted to do something grand. And it felt grand. And now I understand that theater was just the medium, that we could have been doing almost anything with kids. It was the doing of it that was important, and that sense of trying to inspire kids to live into being their best selves. And, of course, doing that all along the way ourselves.
Yeah, I really appreciated in your story all the different ways you wrote about theater and the power of theater and what it did, and also that immersive experience for kids and that opportunity to be involved in a thing that feels important to them. I think that that was really, you know, very clear in the stories that you tell.
Thank you.
So what about, I think it's always helpful for teachers who have a lot of experience to think about and to share with other teachers what advice you would give to teachers who are just starting out in the profession. So what are the things that
right.
you would say to new teachers?
I get to do that because I'm a head of school, so I get to hire people to come teach with us. And I think some of my mantras are to make sure you keep your sense of humor, to remember that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and everybody is tired at the beginning of the semester, in the middle of the semester, and at the end of the semester. And that just kind of goes with the territory. But a wise teacher once said to me that the teaching is not what we're paid for. We're actually paid to correct papers. Because the teaching is pure joy. Being with kids, that's the amazing piece. And I've always, I think of that woman, I think she was a history teacher long ago. And I also had a mentor who counseled me when I was quite a young teacher to listen more than I talked, both in the classroom and as a colleague. And that is real wisdom. And it hurt my feelings when she offered it to me. But now mm-hmm. I think, how lucky I was that she cared enough about me to say, you know what, you don't have to show you're the smartest person in the room. Like, you can always shine light on other people. And I think that really helped change my teaching. And I would also say another mantra that I believe in is when grown-ups put the needs of the child at the center, they all do the right thing. When we get distracted by our own adult agendas and power and stuff that is just in the way, we forget. But when we sort of recenter and put the needs of the child at the center, everybody does the right thing.
Oh, that's such great advice. Thank you. And would you read an excerpt from your piece for us?
Oh, my gosh, I'm so honored. I'm actually really just honored to be here. Okay, so here we go. In rehearsal for Brex, the Caucasian Chalk Circle, Julia, playing Grusha, wondered what it would feel like to be responsible for an infant while climbing over a mountain. I handed her my six-month-old daughter and told Julia to carry her across the platforms of the unfinished set. She froze. I said, "You won't break her." And then she began to climb the flight of steps to the narrow bridge between two high platforms. I held my breath. They crossed. I exhaled. "She's heavy," Julia said, returning the baby to me. "I was scared I'd drop her." "Me too." "Then why did you let me carry her?" "Grusha would be scared too, right?" "Trust, breathe, love, risk." Kids grow up. I continue teaching. It's a glorious water wheel. Many of our ETC kids are frozen in my mind's eye. I see them flushed with the thrill of having focused a light high up in the beams, or having made biscuits for the first time, or having nailed a Shakespearean sonnet. On the last night of the program, we chant together, "Nothing gold can stay," the poem we master on the first night. The first lines go like this: "Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold, her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour."
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much. That moment really stood out for me as I was reading and just thinking about what an amazing illustration of trust that was and what a beautiful moment. So thank you for reading.
She has three babies now, and we still think, I'm still in touch with her, and we still think about that moment. Well, sometimes I think, what was I thinking? But I knew it was what she needed.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. So I think we'll go ahead, and Mike, thank you for being here tonight. I'm wondering if you will jump in, and let's start with the same question. How and when did you decide to become a teacher?
Well, and I'm still not sure that I really have. I ended up sort of in the circumstances, I guess, of teaching, which is to say that I joined the service organization Teach for America fresh out of Stanford in 2002, not so much imagining that I was actually becoming an educator, so much as that I was on some kind of a mission to go into the rural Black public schools in the Mississippi Delta and create some measure of justice. As it happened, I saved exactly no child from poverty or the life that they were born into, but somewhere along the way, I was made into an educator. And for the last, 11 years, I've been teaching low-income first-gen students of color and diversity retention at the University of Oregon. So I guess I ended up finding a calling somewhere along the way.
I did think, actually, I thought that came up in many stories that people would say a similar thing, I think, that they didn't decide to become a teacher, but that it ended up being the right thing for them and that the pathway was not necessarily what you would expect. So you write in your story, you wrote about a student named Tevin, and I'm wondering if you will talk a little bit about him and why he stands out in your memory and the impact that he had on you so early in your career.
Yeah, well, so, you know, Tevin was, I think, one of my greatest struggles my first year of teaching, which itself was a nightmare. I was in over my head. I was utterly unprepared for the ways that poverty presents itself in my 9 to 13-year-old fourth graders. Tevin himself was a foster child, as I eventually found out. He wouldn't actually speak or respond to questions at all. He was taller than many of the other kids, although he had a habit of sort of smiling in response to everything without actually speaking. And as his 10th foster placement, foster father, I guess, in this case, told me, you know, he'd come through the system and been bouncing from place to place, and the only thing that he responded to was a strong man with a stick. And, of course, I was in a place that used corporal punishment routinely, so, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child was sort of the mantra. And so from all directions, as I sort of searched for information and for what I might do to reach this young man who was constantly confronting me in the classroom, I was urged to beat him into submission and establish, I guess, some kind of order for the classroom and respect on his behalf. I suppose that at the time, as someone coming from the West Coast, I was not exactly prepared for what that meant. And, Tevin eventually, I guess, sort of escalated his behavior in class. It got to the point where the assistant principal was unwilling to deal with him. And eventually, I guess, it's all sort of culminated in my classroom in a particular moment in which I think I had to examine myself and what I was willing to do in anger and see if whether or not I could reckon with who that made me. And so I think in many ways what happened with Tevin is kind of a microcosm of what happened to me in the 2 years I taught in Rome, Mississippi. That is to say, I was not a very good teacher. I was probably should have been better known for my failures than for any, sort of dangerous minds moments I had in which I inspired children to heights of success and achievement. But in reckoning with the sort of crucible of that experience and in looking back at the children who, as Anne was sort of saying, you know, I really did love spending time with, I sort of found myself, I think, somewhere in the course of those failures and those experiences, which maybe I couldn't really face or reckon with for a long time.
I would say, I mean, this story really did resonate with me a lot, and I've actually retold it to many teachers and people who are not teachers since I read it, and it just made me think so much about, I think, like exactly what you said, that sometimes our failures as teachers really help us figure out our identity and our beliefs and who we're going to be, especially in those early years as you try to sort of navigate what it means to work with young people and how to best serve them. So I think it's a very powerful story. So what about you? What advice would you give to teachers who are just starting out in the profession?
I mean, I think humility has to come first and foremost. And of course, that's a really hard thing to say to to anyone in their 20s, because it's almost impossible to understand what you actually mean by that until you've sort of reckoned with the years that come after the mistakes that you'll make as a result of arrogance and assumption. But I think I would also say to first-year teachers that you ought to learn to forgive yourself for your mistakes. I think we take those things really, really hard when we're young, and we internalize them. I think maybe to the extent that has to do with that statistic that says this, that something like half of teachers will leave before their fifth year in the classroom. I think it's also really important in general not to recreate the wheel. I know that I tried to, literally make all of my curriculum, which is probably the most absurd thing for a self-contained classroom that one could do. So I think, the sort of mantra, beg, borrow, and steal is probably a good one to keep in mind as well.
Mm-hmm. I often find myself saying to new teachers, I think, which exactly related to what you're saying, it does get better, you just have to give it time. And it will get better. But, it's hard in the beginning, and it's hard to have that humility and to forgive yourself because you want to do just what's right for all the people, all the young people in your classroom. So I think I want to switch gears a little bit. And as a writing teacher myself, I'm always really curious about people's writing process. So would you talk to us a little bit about your process for writing this particular piece?
Well, and so it's very interesting with this particular piece, but this is ended up sort of being a chapter that is a self-contained piece of the memoir that I wrote of the teaching in Mississippi teacher, of which this the section that's in the anthology are sort of excerpts from two different chapters. And I wrote them over many, many years. What actually happens with the young man that I call Tevin in this piece, I originally actually wrote when I believed that I was writing fiction, but I didn't really have that much of a talent for writing fiction. And so, in fact, what I ended up doing was writing exactly what had happened with a protagonist who was a thinly veiled proxy for me, in which I made up exactly nothing. and I think sort of over time, as I've reckoned with my own process for writing creative nonfiction and essay, I've realized that, I need time usually to write really well. I have to have some great investment or stake in what it is I'm writing, and I have to care deeply about the people who are there, not just myself, but also the other people who that I'm writing about, and that there has to be sort of something at stake that I can't actually explain or name. And that means that for me in writing, creative nonfiction, one of the tools that I use probably the most commonly is retrospection, right? Which is just a way of making sense of the past from the vantage point of the present. I need that space and that sort of clarifying time where the years that have come between, have that explanatory and clarifying power where I'm able to understand now what exactly something meant, even if at the time I didn't really understand it or couldn't exactly reckon with it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah
it's also
great.
Interesting to me. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was thinking about what Lee was saying as, someone who teaches writing or as a writer, which I think is sort of how I think of myself. I would say equally sort of in some ways in terms of being a teacher, but because I've written a book about teaching that is about realizing an identity as a teacher, it's been really interesting for me to sort of watch the ways that those two things intertwine. I actually was able to write and finish this particular chapter after, something like the 50th time that I had taught a group of, first-generation college students who were 18 to write and reckon with their own sort of experiences of the past as a way of, articulating their own identity and naming who they were. And so, in the process of teaching a bunch of essays in class and teaching creative nonfiction and asking people to be willing to reckon with their own culpability and what had happened and who it had made them, at some point in me saying that over and over again in the classroom, it was as if one day I realized that there were all of these children whose names I had not spoken in years, you know, and who I couldn't speak of without having to explain things that I had done, which I really wasn't maybe entirely prepared to tell the audiences of people. And that maybe if I would ask my students to write about things in their own lives that were that important, then maybe I should do so myself.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Rachel, this is Lee.
Can I
say something? I'm really appreciative of Mike's comments here. And he brought up two things that I think are really important. And one, how long it takes to be able to write a completely true story. You don't sit down and write it just because it happened. You sit down and write it again and again, and the past gradually becomes the present on your page. And sometimes we writers want to rush into print, and that's probably not the best thing to do. We need to nurture our pieces just like we nurture our students and let them grow and build so that we can do the other thing that Mike has mentioned that I think is really important, so that we can be reflective about it, because it's our responsibility not just to create or recreate something that happened. We have to tell our readers what they mean not only to us, but what they should mean to them.
Yeah, that's so true and such a good point. I'm glad you jumped in and said that and pulled that out. And I was actually thinking right along those same lines of this, what's added when you think of, you know, like you said earlier, Lee, being a writer, teacher, writer who also teaches writing, but then as Mike pointed out, this other level of reflecting about teaching and what happens when you write about your own teaching as a teacher of writing, that there really is that important element of reflection that's added in that kind of writing, especially writing about true stories like these all are. Okay,
yeah,
Mike, would you read an excerpt from your piece for us?
Yeah, I'm going to, you know, sort of finish or read the end of the interaction that I described with Tevin Downs, who, again, had sort of been increasingly confrontational and who everyone had been urging me to beat into submission. I should say that right before this, my principal had told me essentially that she had discovered that he was actually, you know, 13, nearly 14, and that he could be resourced as a way of sort of getting him out of the classrooms, and that either I was supposed to get him in line or else we should send him away. Around 10, the door opened, and Tevin Downs walked in, grinning. He was wearing the wrong color uniform, his polo red Friday, when it was only Wednesday. Hi, Tevin. Have a seat. He walked to the front of the room until he stood inches from me. He wasn't sweating, seemed cool and calm. Sit down. Now? He met my eyes and stepped closer still until his face was inches from mine. And then he spoke, his breath hot to my cheek. No. Sit. You will sit down now, he hawked, a throaty sound, and then as the children gasped, he spit on my face. Some of it was in my eye, the wet, warm mucus sliding down my cheek, and anger and instinct rose in me. I seized him by the collar, rage summoning the strength of the college wrestler I'd been, and half lifted him off his feet, kicking and fighting to the door of the classroom, throwing it open. Get out of my classroom, I said, and tossed him in a great arc into the hall. He tumbled to the floor as the children gasped. It felt good. I wiped the spittle from my face with a sleeve as the children gaped. Tevin sat up astonished, slowly brushed his shirt clean as I stood over him in the doorway. I waited for him to rise and come at me for a sign of resentment, but instead he stood timidly, waited for me to move from the door to pass, shuffled quickly to his desk, and then, cheek to the desk, began the math worksheet he missed earlier in the morning. I looked about the room, and every child whose eyes had been on me turned down to the work there. For the moment, they were scared of me as I was scared now of myself. As we sweated through the day, I saw in Tevin's subdued manner that his respect was authentic. I'd established dominance, the only order Tevin had ever known. And I felt ill with the knowledge that at the day's end, I'd tell Miss Burtonson to resource the boy, to send him away. What he required, I couldn't afford to give.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris. Thank you for being here. I think we'll go ahead and transition to hearing a little from you. And I think I would like to start with the question about what the influence that becoming a teacher has had on your life. So in what ways has being a teacher changed you, and how does it continue to influence you?
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Teaching has changed my life in so many ways. You know, I developed such a fondness for these kids that I wanted to help in other ways. And I was teaching down in something called the Rio Grande Valley area of South Texas. So I was able to, over the summer, get an attorney work pro bono attorney position for an organization that interviews unaccompanied and undocumented minors apprehended at the border. So my job was to interview the males at the boys' home and see who I could reunite with relatives here in the U.S. And you just hear some harrowing stories. They were the same age group as my middle school students. And, you know, it was such a sad experience because so many got deported back to their home countries and this poverty and unsafe neighborhoods. But the teaching experience in middle school just made these kids, this age group, so important to me that I wanted to kind of go out and see where else I could, you know, kind of contribute. I tell you, I was addicted. I am to that feeling you get when you see a kid really understand something. You see her do something she never thought she could do. Just those moments when they smile at you and thank you, or just can see, you just can see the entire change in their disposition when they finally feel good at something. So I knew I wanted to continue that. And now I'm actually a professor here in Pittsburgh. And the funny thing is, something I've taken from the middle school experience is that college kids respond to the same things middle school kids do. So, you know, I have to tell my students to forgive me if I turn into a middle school teacher sometimes. So that means stickers on papers, tossing out mini candy bars for correct answers, sincerely asking them about their day, or making office time to chat about their work or anything else on their mind. You know, a learner of any age wants to know that the work they do is appreciated and they're being guided by someone they respect and trust. And I think of that as myself as well as a lifelong learner, all of us. We want to be appreciated as a person and educated as a learner. And I think we owe it to our students to do just that. And so that's just something I've carried with me from the middle school experience now to the college experience.
Yeah, that's great. I actually, what you said about this feeling you get when you see a kid really understand something reminded me back to something that Anne said earlier about how when we put the needs of the child at the center, or if we, you know, we think about our kids, that's what's really rewarding, and it helps us focus and not, you know, really focus on the teaching and not the other parts of the job so much. So that I really see that connection there as you think about what you can do with kids and that joy you get when you see that you've really taught them something.
Absolutely.
So you took, yeah. So you said just a little bit about how you decided to become a teacher. Would you add, you know, maybe just a little bit more about how that decision came about and you know, how you got to where you are now?
Absolutely. You know, it happened kind of as an accident. During my last semester of law school, I obtained kind of my dream job. I've always wanted a foreign service officer for the U.S. State Department. So that's where I was headed. And once you're hired, you're on this 18-month kind of waiting list to get pulled up. And there are some things going on politically, so all the Middle Eastern experts kind of jumped to the top of that list. So basically, after 18 months on this list, the job disappeared. And so, you know, I wasn't able to kind of sustain a law job because I knew I was leaving. So I ended up just kind of devastated in Austin, Texas, got my law degree, bar exam, can't keep a job because I know I'm leaving. So I didn't know what to do. An old roommate was living in South Texas, which is about 4 hours south of Austin, 4 or 5 hours. And so I just got in the car and drove. And he told me about a program teaching middle school where they help you pay back your college loans if you're bilingual. And I had a bunch of law school debt. You know, it sounded like a good idea. So I just jumped on it and stayed down there in the Rio Grande Valley, that's South Texas, and got hired the week after that. This was a time, you know, quite a few years ago when hiring practices were a bit different. So I actually took an emergency certification course after I began teaching. They just asked in the interview, can you coach? Yes. Do you want to teach history? Okay. And next thing you know, I had a job starting 2 days later. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you figure it out once you get there, right?
Absolutely. It was definitely trial by fire. Kind of learn as you're doing it. It was a good description of what actually happened there. Yeah.
Mhm. Absolutely. Well, what about a student that stands out in your memory? Will you do you have one you could tell us about?
I do. Yeah, you know, I was a roving teacher, and so I had this cart, and the kids named the cart Betsy. So I'd be wheeling it around the school, kind of like Don Quixote's horse that I mentioned in my excerpt. And I always remember this one kid, Ilario was his name, big brown eyes, and he'd just stare at me. And he was actually in the sixth grade, and I was teaching the seventh grade with my cart wheeling around. But so in between classes and in the hallways, I just see him watching me. And eventually he started coming to talk to me and seeking me out in the hallways and things like that. And there was just something about this kid. He looked a little rough, and I couldn't quite figure out why he was so interested in me, why he was always just kind of watching me. And eventually I'd learned just from asking around, he was one of eight kids. He was the oldest. His dad was an alcoholic. Neither parent spoke any English. He was sort of a bigger kid, kind of a bruiser. And so we got him involved in football. Then they put him in my classes when he moved to the seventh grade. And I learned he had reading difficulty, and we worked through that. He was smart and spoke English pretty well. He just had so much energy and pent-up aggression. But he really liked me. He would do whatever I said. You know, he was still getting in trouble all the time, but I worked with other teachers to kind of get strategies to keep him interested and invested, you know, in school. And, you know, boys this age need male role models, and there are not many males teaching elementary or middle school. And, you know, I hadn't experienced that before, being so important to someone, just knowing that whatever I said, whatever I did, however I looked, I was being watched and emulated in a sense. So it was just, you know, it was a bad time for me. You know, the whole I'm a lawyer teaching middle school. My relationship had just ended back in Austin. You know, I had this superiority complex. I'm a lawyer. What do you do? You know, kind of ironic since we all did the same thing. We taught middle school. So this kid just really got me out of my own head, my own depression, my own kind of poor me mentality, and allowed me to feel something. I had closed up a lot since the law school and the whole State Department not getting that job. And it was like me and he were kind of in each other's life for a reason. I didn't quite really know how important this kid was to me. But then maybe 2 years after I taught him, I had heard that he was dragged off a bus in high school. He had gotten involved with some gangs and selling drugs and things like that. So, and I heard he was hurt pretty badly. And then, you know, later that week I was just jogging through the neighborhood. And I ran by a church, and I'm not super religious, but I did stop, and I knelt down to pray. I wasn't even sure what I was praying for, and then, you know, he just popped into my mind and my vision, and just tears started flowing, and I just realized how important he was to me. And that was, I think, the most significant experience I've had with a particular student, and they give as much to us as we give to them, you know, probably more. And I'm happy to say that him and I are Facebook friends now, and he's a little older, not doing too badly for himself. So that was kind of nice too, when a student that you don't even think would remember you or whatever kind of seeks you out. In that case, it was Facebook. He lives in a different state, you know. So that was nice that in some way I was somewhat of importance and influence on him the same way that he was quite important to me at that time.
Yeah, that's such a good point about how much, you know, first of all, I mean, actually a lot of good points there in that story, but one is that when a lot of times when we're a new teacher and young, it's you don't realize the kinds of connections you can actually make with students even as you're figuring out how to be a good teacher and how they will find you and reach out to you if they see you as someone that you, as a role model for them or that they, you know, can really connect to. And then also the point about how, you know, just remembering how much of an impact they can, individual students can have on us, and that also that often we have impact on students, individual students that we don't even realize. So, yeah, that story really illustrates so many things about those kinds of connections.
Oh, yeah.
So would you read an excerpt from your piece?
I would. I'll go ahead and read right from the end here. The class spends the next 50 minutes fixing up Betsy. Javier reconnects Betsy's joints with several metal hangers he took from the locker room. Rafael reinforces the middle shelf with layers of electrical tape. Gloria glues fringe from her purse along the top of the electrical tape. They remind me of a NASCAR pit crew. Roxy adds a braided tail. Their enthusiasm is compelling. Watching them, I consider the love Don Quixote felt for his horse, Rosinante. I feel something, too. Javier glues on a few more glass beads he stole from someone's science fair project. Roxy tilts more Christmas glitter on wet glue. She turns towards me and smiles. Looks good, huh, sir? I place my hands in my pockets and tilt my head in agreement. Now you can fight those windmills, says Javier. He offers me a soft sucker punch in the kidneys. I throw up my arm and lower my elbow, stopping inches above Javier's head. I look out at the scurrying mass of students before me. These children are not victimized charity cases, as the Teach for America literature would have me believe, nor are they long-armed enemy. You can't wrestle windmills. Instead, these are real children with real problems, ranging from abusive parents and unidentified learning disabilities to the simple self-doubt and acne that plague children the whole world over. They are simply kids. Finished, Javier says after a few more minutes. He wheels Betsy toward the podium. I look at Javier and then at my horse. He beams with pride. The class surrounds him, inspecting their good work. Venerable sage, wise enchanter, whatever be thy name, thou whom fate has ordained to be the compiler of my history, I read aloud. Forget not, I beseech thee, my trusty Rosinante, the eternal companion of all my adventures. The class claps on cue, all except Roxy, who, 1,000 times more beautiful than Lady Dulcinea, takes the gum out of her mouth, finally, and reinforces Betsy's tale.
Thank you.
Of course.
That passage itself actually makes me think back, to think back to something Mike said earlier about that advice to new teachers about being willing to forgive yourself. And there's some element there of not being too hard on yourself also. And I just saw this as such a lovely moment when you realized that the kids were really actually on your side. Just such an important realization and moment to write about. So thank you for reading that for us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, so I want to make sure that we hear from Marcia before the end of our time. So, Marcia, thank you for being here. And I'll start you with the question that I've asked the others. How and when did you decide to become a teacher?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me and us, Rachel. So I'm kind of the outlier in the group. I had been a network television news producer for about 20 years and moved to the country with my family and had just kind of started being a writer, and I was a little adrift. And but I had lived in France for many years and spoke French, and suddenly there was a crisis in the French department because there isn't much where I live, but there are a lot of boarding schools. So like Anne, I kind of started out at a New England boarding school. So there kept on being illness and crises in the department. So I stepped in, and I stepped in for very, very long spells, and it was a great leap of faith on their part. In retrospect, it was a little crazy of them because I really didn't know what I was doing. Speaking a language doesn't mean that you can teach it, especially teaching the grammar. But it was something that I wanted to do, I needed to do. I wasn't sure I had the calling to be a teacher, but it was feasible because I knew it was finite. It was kind of like a project, like preparing a big dinner or some great big finite project that was going to have a beginning and an end. But I was, as an accidental teacher, I never worked as hard in my life. And I had been, around the world, worked 20-hour days in television, and this was by far the most work I had ever done, the most dogged work I had ever done, and surely the most humbling thing that I had done. And at the end, I was kind of conflicted because they dangled the possibility of a permanent position, although the French numbers were going down and more people were taking Spanish and Chinese. And the job went away. They didn't need another French teacher, and I wished that they had. And I'd like to teach again, actually, maybe not French, but writing or essay writing. I think I could do it now and do it perhaps better.
Yeah, you said a little bit about what was challenging about you know, jumping in and being a substitute teacher. Would you just talk a little bit more about what was challenging about this particular way of going into teaching and what those first few weeks of being a substitute teacher were like?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think you could sum it all by imposter syndrome. I didn't really know that I was doing what I was doing. I was certain that the kids would know that I didn't know what I was doing, that all my faults and foibles would be very much on display. I didn't realize, I didn't understand kind of the performance aspect of being a teacher, especially speaking a foreign language. I really did feel like I was performing, like I was on stage. You know, I felt like an actor in a one-man show, kind of. I was very, very afraid. And I was also, I kind of hadn't had the sensitivity training, I guess. I was afraid that I'd look too opinionated about one student or in support of one student and against another. I mean, it was hard to kind of keep my equanimity and to kind of be neutral. And, you know, I didn't want to favor the person who was very prepared and speak angrily or accusatorily, to the person who wasn't prepared. So I was afraid about my personal preferences showing up. And, my other lack of qualifications, I was afraid to be alone in an office with a student. I wasn't sure, you know, I knew about repercussions and a lot of things that inexperience made me afraid of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I know that you are a teacher of writing in your French class too, which is a unique and different space to be teaching writing. So would you talk a little bit about teaching writing to your French students and what kind of writing they did in your class and how that impacted their learning of language?
Sure. Well, I didn't really teach writing. I would give them essays to write, you know, in a test or a take-home, you know, incorporating the vocabulary or something that we had done or kind of a little homework assignment for Christmas vacation. So they had to use the vocabulary that they had in telling a personal story about themselves. So I taught five levels.